Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 26th of March. Our guest this hour is the editor of a really good book about Ted Kennedy. It's titled Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. You'll recall that Churchill was talked about as the last lion. John McCain in May of 2008 said, I've described Ted Kennedy as the last lion of the Senate. He remains the single most effective member of the Senate if you want to get results. Some have suggested that he is the best senator ever, and that's dealt with in this wide-ranging book. Our guest this hour is the editor of Last Lion, Peter Canellos, and Peter is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, oversees all national coverage for the paper. He's worked there since 1988, covering local, state, and national politics. And then there are a number of people from the Globe who contributed to this very deep book. So we're happy to have Peter with us this hour. And to welcome your phone calls, we'll get the conversation rolling here. Feel free to join our conversation anytime along the way. The number to speak with Peter is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Hello, Peter. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I never thought I'd start with this, but I guess I have to because I've been telling everybody in the office. I had no idea that Ted Kennedy was a good enough football player that the Packers expressed interest. I mean, the Packers are a religion in Wisconsin, so we've got to start with them.
Well, I think that was more his father, Joe Kennedy, who controlled a lot of his upbringing, arranged through friends to have him sort of visit the training camp. So I'm not sure that he was really of professional caliber, but he was a really good player and a good collegiate player. And, you know, people associate his brothers, Jack and Bobby, with having this sort of vigorous presentation. But actually, Ted was the athlete in the family. There's very little doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. It must have been, you know, the early part of these children's lives is so interesting to me. And to be the last of nine children, you talk about Rose saying, well, you know, you try to give everybody the same kind of attention, et cetera. But after having so many children after so many years, there's something about the last child that's meaningful, and you get at that in the book.
Absolutely. And it's meaningful, I think, when the child is little, they're the baby of the family, there's a sort of special affection that is visited on them. But in Ted Kennedy's case, you know, over time, he was called upon to sort of comfort his parents through the loss of many of their older children. And by the time he came along, too, Joe and Rose Kennedy were living somewhat separate lives, so he developed more individualistic relationships with each of them. So I think that they really did have a special feeling for him.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like he really had a special relationship with his mom.
He certainly did, and the Catholic Church played a large part
yes.
in that. Rose
yeah.
Kennedy was an extremely devout Catholic and really spent a lot of time trying to persuade her children to go to church. Jack was a special challenge to her. She would send him notes even when he was running for president saying, just one word, church. You know, but she never had to persuade Teddy. You know, she just said it, and Teddy went. And I think that Teddy found that, you know, the church was a comfort to his mother during the many trials in her life, and it has been a comfort to him, just to go to Mass, sit somewhere in the middle of the pews, and sort of be quiet for a period of time.
And frequently by himself, right?
Yes, frequently by himself. And it was recently as about 5 years ago when his daughter Kara had an experience with cancer. You know, he went every day to Mass to try to find the strength to help her confront that illness.
When you think of the strength that one human being has to find, oh my gosh, it's hard to imagine a life that needs more of that strength than Teddy Kennedy's.
It is hard to imagine. Mm. I mean, it's in some ways a sort of well-told aspect of his life, you know, all of the Kennedy tragedies, because the American public has been party to it. And mm-hmm. particularly, you know, in Massachusetts, people say, why did Ted Kennedy remain popular when there were incidents like the Chappaquiddick incident and, you know, the Palm Beach scandal involving his nephew and all that kind of thing. And I think there was a feeling, particularly in Massachusetts, but also throughout the country among certain people, that they had You know, they had gone through all of this, had gone through two assassinations, had gone through all these other tragedies, the death of JFK Jr., you know, all these things with Ted Kennedy, and it sort of created a kind of bond. It made him a part of American life that, you know, in a way that could never really be denied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was that? I mean, you write about there being a different reaction in the country, but after the Chappaquiddick affair, where was it that he showed up and he was trying to decide whether or not he should not run again for the Senate, that this had done him in and he wasn't going to do it, and lots of people supported this man, from Massachusetts particularly.
I think that's true. I think somewhat as with Richard Nixon's famous Checkers speech, it was a little bit of a gesture that was calculated to draw that kind of response. You know, I don't think that Ted Kennedy was really in his mind certain that he wanted to give up the Senate seat. I think that, you know, his aides prevailed on him to sort of call on average people to kind of, you know, send their feelings to him. And it was sort of a bet that bond that people felt towards Ted Kennedy would prevail at that moment and sort of show the doubters that people were still behind Kennedy. And it worked. And it worked. But in his own mind, I'm not sure he was ever ready to give up the Senate seat.
Mm-hmm. You write this in the intro to the book, in 1969, after Chappaquiddick, that friends could only wonder if he knew that he would spend his life searching for redemption.
I think after Chappaquiddick, there was some truth to that, in that, you know, the Chappaquiddick incident, I think many of our listeners sort of know what it was, but there was a woman in his car who died. You know, late at night, he was driving to the beach, in the direction of the beach, on an island off the coast of Massachusetts, and the car went off a rickety bridge and into a fast-moving channel, and while he said he swam down six or seven times to try to save the woman, he didn't rush to get help immediately, and he didn't report the accident for 8 hours. And I think that the takeaway from that, for many, many people feeling it to this day, is that, you know, Ted Kennedy was a selfish person, that when confronted with this test, you know, a kind of basic test of humanity, instead of running to get help at the first opportunity, you know, he paused and thought of his image or thought of his political career. Now, he has denied that. He said that it was because he was dazed and because he, you know, had a concussion, and a lot of people believe that. But a lot of people also believe that there was calculation included. So confronted with that charge, that, you know, he's a privileged person who doesn't care about the average person, I think he's gone out of his way in the years and decades since then to refute it on two levels. You know, one is through his very hard work in the Senate. Another is in really intervening on a personal level with people who've experienced tragedy. Mm-hmm. And this is something that comes out in our book that I think people don't know and really has never been written about. But, you know, there are people who... families who've lost somebody who's a police officer killed in the line of duty, certainly service members killed overseas. You know, they often say the first call they ever received was from Ted Kennedy, and really? He was so personal in talking to them. And I think there's an element of, you know, of trying to sort of defend and assert his humanity in those exchanges.
Mm-hmm. And there was also earlier you have an interesting description of Joe Kennedy when Teddy wasn't doing very well at Harvard. He had to leave for a while, and his father thought his Army experience at that time would be good for him because he would be exposed to all of humanity. Was it important for him?
I think it was very important. Now, it wasn't just that he wasn't doing well at Harvard. It was that he had been caught in a cheating scandal,
right,
where one of his football teammates was taking a test for him. And both he and the young man who took the test were required to leave for a minimum of 2 years. And his father obviously was shocked and disappointed, but was already looking ahead to a possible political career for Ted, as Joe Kennedy Sr. dreamed for all his sons. And he was shrewd enough to say, you know, you're going to go into the Army and you're going to meet people from all walks of life, and this is going to be an important lesson for you. Now, the older Kennedy boys, including his eldest brother, Joe Jr., they were all in the Navy, and the Navy is a little more hierarchical than the Army, and the Kennedy boys were all officers. Ted was a real grunt. He was, you know, a private in the, in the three levels below sea level on a troop ship, washing trays and performing menial tasks. And he was challenged by people, you know, who resented his wealthy background. And he was challenged to fights, and he was called names. And he had to learn to win those people over and to understand those people. And so in later years, when people who knew all the Kennedy brothers said, you know, one-on-one, Ted Kennedy was by far the most sensitive and the most engaged in terms of understanding people and sort of right away making contact with people, they trace it to that experience in the Army.
Interesting. And he seemed to, from your description of him early in life, be, except for the time maybe when he was really lonely and cut off from his family, to be the most gregarious of the Kennedy boys.
Yes, and I think some of that comes from his childhood. You know, we all saw those and have seen those pictures of the Kennedys sort of romping on the beach at Hyannis and playing touch football and things like that. But for Ted Kennedy, it was a much lonelier experience because he was the youngest, and he was the youngest by 4 years. His sister Jean was the next oldest. And he was constantly moving around because his parents were moving many different places when he was young, and he was sent to a lot of boarding schools, at one point 10 different schools in 11 years.
Goodness.
And, you know, people like kids like that have to, they have to adjust. They have to meet new people. They have to get to make friends easily, and that's sort of what happened to him.
Mm-hmm. And he was always, we hear about, you know, the great love, and you write about how his father loved him dearly, et cetera. But this thing about being a fat kid and not worrying about whether or not he was very intelligent, they were pretty open with their criticism of Teddy.
Yeah, they were absolutely merciless.
Yeah.
And some of this comes from, you know, letters that have just been, you know, released in the last 10 years by the Kennedy Library, where because Joe and Rose Kennedy were each traveling so often by themselves, they communicated with their children with very rigorous letter writing, and sometimes they'd write letters to all of the kids, sometimes they'd write letters to some of the kids individually, and they were quite open in their criticisms and just relentless in terms of portraying Teddy as a fatty and demanding that he lose weight and being sarcastic about his love of eating all the time. They also were very tough on him and his school record, to the point where Rose Kennedy would sometimes chide his teachers for not being tougher on him. So the surprise in all of this is that, you know, you read these letters and you think, oh, my God, you know, how could he handle being raised by these two exacting parents? And in fact, you know, he loves them and honors their memory and insists to this day that they were the most wonderful parents any child could have, and that, you know, his entire life has been spent trying to live up to their example.
Hmm. Tell me about his relationship. We know about President Kennedy never having any money, and so people would just pay for things because he never had any money, which always struck me as so strange. But I guess the same was true for Teddy, that you write about the father having trust funds for each of them so they wouldn't have to worry about money, but stressing the fact that they need a life of public service. Did Teddy walk around without any money, too?
Well, there are stories like that, and I think that it's fairly common to hear about very, very wealthy people that they're just so used to having aides and assistants around that you know, money kind of ceases to exist for them in a certain way. Now, against that, it should be said that, you know, Ted Kennedy has been independently wealthy, but he's not lived a very ostentatious life. He's had, you know, large, comfortable homes, but he's not, you know, his homes have never been all that much updated. The place that, you know, is his main home now in Hyannisport, you know, is kind of an old wooden, you know, arc of a house that that doesn't have the latest appointments. So he's not lived particularly ostentatiously, but like a lot of people who know wealth, you know, he's not thinking about money all the time either.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number for you to talk with Peter. Peter is the editor of Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. He's also the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe and oversees all of the national coverage for the paper. He's worked there since 1988. And this book about Kennedy is by the team at the Boston Globe, so a lot of reporters contributed to this examination of Ted Kennedy's life, his career in the Senate, the time in Chappaquiddick, his early life, his career as a senator, an incredibly effective senator, his role as the head of the Kennedy clan. We'll talk about all of that coming up. And so join us, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Kanellos is our guest. The book is Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. And let's go to John from Milwaukee for our first call. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just like to say that Teddy Kennedy owes me $15.72 for breakfast back in 1980 when he was campaigning for president in Wisconsin. I don't know if you remember that. It was during March. And we were up in Appleton, and no money in the pocket, either for the bill or for the tip. But
oh no,
it was wonderful because we had a chance to talk about Catholicism at that breakfast and the wonderful effect that, especially his mother had, because he was the only one of the three sons who actually became an altar boy and served regularly when he was growing up, even until young adulthood. And I think that this had a tremendous, especially the Latin, just a tremendous effect on his life all throughout, and a tremendous source of consolation for him. And I think you could credit that to his mom.
Peter.
Yes, I mean, I think there's no question that Catholicism has played a tremendous role in his life and has given him two things. It's given him the strength to withstand all of the tragedies and other reversals in his life, which, as we were saying earlier, have been, you know, extraordinary and more than most people could handle. I think he also, derived some of his commitment to public service from charity and from, you know, the Catholic workers tradition. And there's no question that, for a person born with his wealth and with his, the tremendous ambitions of his father and mother propelling him forward, Catholicism has had a grounding effect on him. You know, it's had a humanizing effect on him. And, I certainly agree that he is the most religious of his brothers, for sure.
How is it that the parents, and I assume it came from the parents, unless it was something else, had trust funds for all of these kids? They never had to really worry about money. They knew they wouldn't have to worry about money in their lifetime, and yet they went into such deep lives of public service. How were the parents able to accomplish that? It would be very easy. It seems to me as though it would be pretty easy to become a loafer.
Yeah, it's true. Well, one of the most difficult parts was probably earning the money in the first place. But Joe Kennedy Sr. is an intriguing figure. You know, he's sort of an American dreamer, a little bit of a Great Gatsby kind of figure, in that he became deeply involved in his business career, which involved liquor distribution, and also put him in touch with a lot of unsavory characters. And there have been various reports over the years of all kinds of skeletons in his closet on the business side of his life. He always believed that business, perhaps for that reason, was sort of fundamentally dirty. You know, what he wanted for his kids, who were, you know, the grandchildren of Irish-American immigrants. He was a grandchild. They were the great-grandchild of Irish-American immigrants. He wanted them to be able to live the kind of life that the New England Yankees did, who were, you know, living off of trust funds and were living the sort of a life of service. And, you know, Joe Kennedy wanted to raise his sons to be statesmen and his daughters to be, charitable donors and people who give their time. And so he made a big deal out of saying that he was going to give them money so that they would never have to work, and that their side of the deal is that they had to live a life of public service. And I think that he himself had such strong ambitions towards public service and propelling them towards public service that, you know, the message took root. And, you know, even to this day, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Joe Kennedy Sr., you know, still are sort of living by that ethos.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, John, for the call. Let's go to Steve from Lake Mills. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I just wanted to call and ask, what was Ted's relationship with his daughter his sister that lived out here in Wisconsin in St. Coletta near Jefferson? I grew up about a quarter mile from her house, And I remember Rose coming out to visit kind of all secretly, you know, with no fanfare. And I wonder if, what Ted's relationship was with her. She passed away about 2 years ago.
Well, his relationship was that of a devoted brother. Quite often, you know, I think more than most people knew or believed, Rosemary and some of her caregivers from St. Coletta's would, you know, come east and spend holidays with the Kennedys, you know, other kinds of family visits. Ted Kennedy, you know, took very seriously his role as sort of patriarch for the Klan, and while his sister Eunice was always the closest to Rosemary because they had shared more experiences in childhood, and I think Eunice was sort of the primary link between Rosemary and the other Kennedys, you know, Ted was, you know, a very dutiful brother to her. Now, for listeners who don't understand, Rosemary Kennedy was the eldest Kennedy daughter, and she was thought to be mildly retarded, though she, you know, she came out in London society while her father was the ambassador to the court of St. James. She also had been studying to be a Montessori teacher. Nonetheless, she had mood swings and problems that that Joe Kennedy Sr. thought could be helped by having a lobotomy. And it was a disastrous decision because the lobotomy went badly wrong and left her severely disabled for the rest of her life. And she lived to be 85, I believe. So, you know, I think there was tremendous sort of, you know, guilt and a sense of obligation on the part of the other Kennedy children toward Rosemary, having seen what happened to their sister. And, you know, that was the impetus for Eunice Shriver starting the Special Olympics to sort of show that people with disabilities can achieve great things. And, you know, it's Rosemary's experience, I think, has had a profound impact on Ted and all the other Kennedys.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. It was an incredible thing that Father did, though, wasn't it, to just make this decision by himself, not consult with his wife, just go ahead and do this.
It was yes, I think exactly for those reasons it was an incredible decision. The one thing that I think it reflects, which is interesting, is that Joe Kennedy Sr. strongly believed in the latest medical treatments. You know, for a man of his generation who was born really before penicillin had been discovered, you know, he really believed that medical advancements were out there, that were prepared to cure any disease and to help any condition. And he thought that one of the privileges of his wealth was to seek out the most groundbreaking researchers in every area. Now, often this boomeranged terribly on him. He had his son Jack undergo an experimental operation on his back that also had a terrible effect and practically left President Kennedy disabled, and then there was the operation on Rosemary that also went awry. Nonetheless, I think that Joe Kennedy's attitude has influenced Ted Kennedy in his belief in health care, that Ted Kennedy is also somebody who, you know, when a friend or a family member is suffering some kind of illness, he's been known to sort of show up at the door with the latest researchers there at his side to try offer care, and thinks that that's what you're supposed to do. And I think that his desire to, you know, create access for everybody to high-quality medical care is sort of an extension of his father's belief that, you know, the latest care is necessary to leading a productive life.
Mm-hmm. And you write early in the book about his contribution to healthcare in this country, which is pretty phenomenal, quadrupling federal spending on cancer research back in the 70s, secured funding for generations of scientists through the National Institutes of Health, relentlessly expanding the federal role in paying for the health of children, the poor, and the elderly. He has done an incredible amount, and by golly, he wants to keep on this issue as long as he's on this earth, doesn't he?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's something also that people around the country haven't fully appreciated is the extent to which he has accomplished some of these goals. I think if you said to the average person, you know, Ted Kennedy's been a relentless advocate for health care, you know, many people would nod approvingly and say, you know, it's just too bad he never really got a national health plan through. You know, there'd be other people who would look at you and say, I'm really glad he never got a health plan through because we don't think the government should be involved to that extent. But if you look at what he did accomplish, you know, he was there at the inception of Medicare and Medicaid advocating for healthcare for the elderly and for low-income people. His very first campaign in 1962, he did a series of ads aimed at, you know, calling attention to the plight of the elderly facing high medical bills that helped lead to Medicare. He also was behind COBRA, which allowed people to keep their health insurance even if they lost their jobs. He was behind what they call the HIPAA program, which prevented discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions, job discrimination, because they presumably could drive up premiums for the company if they were hired, and companies were denying jobs to people who had medical conditions. And as you mentioned, you know, his funding of the NIH, and there was also the Children's Health Program, which in some states provides health care to families up to 400% of the poverty level, which is quite a few families. So he's been quite successful, even if he hasn't gotten a sweeping national health package through.
Right. Which makes us think of his health. We had an email from Mike asking, how is his health?
Well, he's here in Washington working this week and putting out statements, and he met with the Health and Human Services Secretary, Kathleen Sebelius, earlier this week in his office. He is, you know, somewhat limited in his ability to work. He takes naps during the day. His staff has assured people that, you know, his situation is related to the treatment for his brain cancer, not from the effects of the cancer itself. Mm-hmm. You know, by most assessments, you know, he's already kind of, you know, exceeded what a lot of experts felt would be his prognosis with brain cancer. So he's doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And is he working with Sebelius on fashioning some kind of real significant health care reform? Will he be an important force, or
Yes, he will be. And even, he has participated in some meetings, but even to the extent that he's not particularly visible in Washington, and even when he spent a lot of the winter in Florida, even when he's been away, his relationships in the Senate are such that, you know, having him available even by phone to sort of lobby other senators and to help bring people together is considered an invaluable resource to the people trying to create a bill. So, you know, he is absolutely a central player, you know, even if he's not as active as he would have been a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. And what about this idea that he may be the most effective senator who was ever in that body? You toss that around in the book.
Yes, we do. And I think that when you really look at the evidence, there's a strong case that emerges. You know, the Senate in the 19th century was not the activist legislating body that it is today. Just the role of the government was not as strong in people's lives. So it's a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison between 19th century senators and today's senators. And some people would say, well, you know, in the decades leading up to the Civil War, there were three great senators, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, John C. Calhoun, you know, who at various points crafted sort of compromises that helped forestall the Civil War. At other points, they engaged in debates that sort of shaped the issues for the Civil War. You know, those were great statesman-like moments. Nonetheless, they didn't really legislate in the way that Ted Kennedy has. And while there are other people like Lyndon Johnson who were dominant figures in the Senate for a short period of time, nobody's had the length of career and the degree of impact that Kennedy has had.
It's been a long time he's been there, hasn't it? A long time.
It's been 47 years.
Oh,
and
my gosh, yeah.
And he's 46 and a half, I'd say. But during that period, he has been the dominant figure in four major areas, in health, in education, in civil rights, and in immigration. Now, we talked a few minutes ago about health. But in education, you know, during the course of his Senate career, you know, we've more than doubled the percentage of Americans that go to college. And, you know, his advocacy for federal loans and for the creation of community colleges and other, you know, federal involvement in higher education has played a large role in that. Civil rights, you know, he was there. His first major bill was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlawed discrimination in private accommodations. He was a strong advocate for the Voting Rights Bill, for all those things. But his greater contribution was in the 1980s when the Reagan administration wanted to reduce the federal role in enforcing civil rights laws, believing that, you know, it was too intrusive on states' rights. And, you know, Kennedy put together a series of legislative coalitions that not only reauthorized these bills, but did so with a veto-proof majority, sort of sending a signal to President Reagan that, you know, he might make conservative reforms elsewhere, but keep his hands off civil rights. And then in the Robert Bork Supreme Court nomination, it was Kennedy who sort of turned that nomination into a referendum on civil rights laws, and he defeated Bork. So, you know, the civil rights protections, the federal civil rights protections that exist today were saved by Kennedy in the 1980s. I think it's very fair to say that.
And this will weave in the story of his nephew. Do you think that he could have defeated the nomination of Clarence Thomas if it weren't on the heels of his questionable behavior in Palm Beach?
I think it's hard to say. There were sort of two parts to the Clarence Thomas debate. Mm-hmm. The first part was debate over Clarence Thomas's views, and a lot of liberals were kind of flummoxed by the Thomas nomination because they realized that Thomas was very, very conservative. But unlike Bork, he didn't have this long paper trail of history that they could point to of him taking specific views on issues. And, you know, if you recall, you know, Clarence Thomas claimed he had never talked about Roe v. Wade, for example, and stuff. So a lot of liberals were unsure how to proceed. Kennedy opposed Clarence Thomas, but he didn't, you know, do the sort of full-scale assault that he had done against Bork. Now, later, it became a referendum on sexual harassment after Anita Hill's charges came forward. And because Kennedy had been involved, you know, in going out drinking with his nephew before his nephew was accused of rape, you know, Kennedy's personal behavior was such that he really wasn't a good person to criticize somebody mm-hmm. for sexual harassment. And it may have been, you know, if Kennedy had been a full-throated opponent at that point, that he would have swayed enough senators to defeat Thomas. Thomas only got 52 votes, so, you know, two votes fewer, and he would not have been confirmed.
Mm-hmm. What did Anita Hill think of it?
Well, Anita Hill, interestingly, not only spoke to us for the book, but there's also a video of her on Boston.com, which is the Globe's website, talking about this. She said that, you know, the Kennedy's involvement in the Palm Beach thing shows that, you know, public men have to, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk, that it's not enough for somebody like Kennedy to be, you know, an advocate for women's rights, which he certainly has been. It means that in his private life he has to, you know, exemplify respect for women. And the fact that, you know, he was not perceived as doing so, it wasn't so much because he was involved in any way in the allegations against his nephew, but that, you know, he had a reputation for sort of carousing and kind of, flirting during his second bachelorhood between his two marriages. You know, she felt that Kennedy was sort of an imperfect role model. Mm-hmm. And so she was disappointed that he wasn't, you know, able to be a stronger advocate for her against Clarence Thomas. But she also realized that, you know, it wouldn't have worked if he had tried it because he was such a, you know, at that point, compromised figure.
Right. Where is the video? I didn't know about the video. Boston.com?
Yeah, Boston.com. Oh. If you look in Boston.com and look up Kennedy, you'll find a great number of videos that were produced by the Boston Globe for the series we did that accompanied this book. And some of them, seven of them, are you know, fully produced kind of documentary quality videos. But then we also have you know, actual footage of things like the whole entirety of his 1980 Democratic Convention speech, you know, one of his great sort of liberal moments, the Dream Shall Never Die speech. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we have some of those early commercials I was talking about from his 1962 race when he was first advocating for health care and talking about the plight of senior citizens. So there's a lot of great stuff from the years, and, you know, his debate performances against various candidates and things. It's lots of good material.
Yeah. oh, this modern world, right? All you could do. You do a book and then you get to do all these other things. We have to talk about the race against Mitt Romney at some point, too. Our phone number, join the conversation if you'd like. Our guest is the editor of this terrific book on Teddy Kennedy, Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy, put together by the team at the Boston Globe. Peter Canellos is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe and oversees all national coverage for the paper. He's worked there since 1988. In addition to the book, there is this website you can go to find all these archived speeches of Teddy Kennedy's long career. So that's kind of neat, huh? What do you think? Could you consider him? Here's maybe the question that will prompt you to join us, that he has been one of the most effective senators ever. And what do you think about the complexity of his life, the feelings you have, and whether or not they've changed over the course of his many years in the Senate? We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming more phone calls for Peter, who's editor of Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. It's put together by the team at the Boston Globe. 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. Paul from Madison, our next caller. Hi, Paul.
Yes. I was listening to you earlier when you were talking about Chappaquiddick. And, you know, one alternative you did not consider, which may be too late for your guest, since they gather his book has already been published, is that Chappaquiddick was a failed mob rubout. I've been trying to remember the author and title of the book where I got this information. It's in the Historical Society down in Madison. It seems to me the author's last name was Hurt. And I think the title, or half title at least, was Reasonable Doubt. It was published in 1985.
And what does the book say? Yeah, what was the doubt?
Reasonable Doubt, no, I think was the half title.
No, but what's the doubt?
I've been so engrossed in listening to your speaker, I haven't had much time to rack my memory about the details.
Huh.
But one of the points that Hurt makes in this book is that rumor had it that Chappaquiddick was actually a failed attempted mafia rubout, and that they framed it the way they did simply because they didn't want to make it look like, the mafia could kill any Kennedy anytime they felt like it.
Well, I would say that, one of the, legacies of the rather poor, ineffective investigation that the local authorities in Massachusetts did of Chappaquiddick, and there were many lapses, including lack of an autopsy on the body of Mary Jo Kopechne, which, might have revealed if she could have lived longer, if there was some sort of air bubble in the car, a lack of a more definitive inquest into the case. Kennedy was allowed to plead guilty to a sort of lesser offense of leaving the scene of an accident. But lacking a kind of definitive investigative record, a number of people have come forward with these speculations about what might have happened, what could have happened, and this idea that there may have been a mob hit or there may have been other people involved is one that's out there. There are others that suggest that Kennedy had not been aware that Mary Jo was in the car, that she was sleeping in the back, and that he was with some other woman at that time. I mean, there's lots of this stuff that's out there, and in our research, we didn't find anything that suggested that any of the the more elaborate theories were credible. Our research came away essentially feeling like the best evidence, but there's no definitive evidence, but the best evidence is that it was an accident, and that Kennedy's failure to report it and his failure to get help were the salient issues. We'll never know the whole story there. It certainly is a mystery that will continue to dog Kennedy as long as he's alive and will, be a factor in his historical record.
Yeah, well, before you cut me off, let me just say that the relevant chapter in Hurt's book may be chapter 12. It's called The Confession of Robert Easterling, who's a very specific person. I gather you're from Massachusetts. there was a book published up there, which is also in the Historical Society Library down here in Madison, and the title of that is something like, you know, there's 50,000 pounds on my head. That's the approximate title. I don't know the author. But it concerned a man who was in prison, apparently in Massachusetts, who had been solicited for Dallas, in apparently in 1962, agreed to take part in it, got picked up on other charges in the meantime, talked in prison in 1962, 1963 about what had happened to him. Nobody believed him, of course, until you know, Friday, November 22nd. And then all of a sudden, the guy became, front page news inside the prison that he was in. But that book was published in Massachusetts. I don't remember the author's name. It's a very slender volume. But the title of it was something like, there's a price of $50,000 on my head. And the $50,000 might have been written out in printed in numbers, you know, rather than written out in words and letters.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, for your information.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's talk briefly before we go back to calls about Romney and Kennedy in the race in 94, which really was the race of his life, right? He had to bring in all the top people to help him campaign. It looked like Romney might win that initially.
Yes, it did. You know, Kennedy was badly politically damaged by the charges against his nephew, but it was also sort of the accumulation of stories that, between his marriages and the 9 years between his marriages, you know, he was frequently seen out dating, sort of serial dating with younger women, and there were reports of heavy drinking and things like that. And it was nothing sort of inherently problematic with that lifestyle. And, you know, as some people have pointed out, you know, back when his brother was president during the Camelot era, it was considered sort of glamorous for these middle-aged men to have young women around and things. But it was a very different era in the 80s. And, Kennedy was seen as sort of this Austin Powers figure, kind of, you know, a man out of his time, stuck partying in a 60s style in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And then the incident occurred in Palm Beach, and what shocked a lot of people is that, you know, the Kennedy family had gathered for Easter, and Kennedy and his son and his nephew went out to sort of a known pickup bar around midnight, and, though they had a few drinks, and, you know, Kennedy apparently went back and went to bed, later on, his nephew was accused of raping a woman. It sort of crystallized the doubts about his personal life, and that whole sort of man out of time issue, I think, made people feel like he was kind of a spent force, that, he's old before his time. So in 1994, Mitt Romney, who was then 47 years old and, a sort of self-made multimillionaire, but also the son of a well-known politician, Governor George Romney of Michigan, was challenging him as a simply, younger, more vital, more current figure. The race was very close, and there were points at which Romney had pulled ahead of Kennedy sort of early on. It forced Kennedy to really go out there and meet people in Massachusetts. I mean, he had always been very diligent about constituent services, but there was a perception that, the state had changed and that there was a new high-tech economy, and he acquainted himself with that very successfully and, summoned some of the old fire and had a couple of definitive debate performances against Romney where he really, stepped forward and defended himself and his record and his commitment to the people of Massachusetts. He ended up winning in a landslide in a year when almost every other Democrat was defeated. So, what started off as a test of Kennedy's vulnerability became, in the end, sort of proof of Kennedy's strength and endurance.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, and he and Romney became not really close friends, but it was a fairly vicious campaign, but they became friends.
They did, a lot of the anger was on Romney's side because one of Kennedy's nephews had raised issues about Romney's Mormon faith, and Romney felt that was particularly inappropriate for the Kennedys, who had been suffered from discrimination early on as Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
And, Romney felt like Ted Kennedy had not sufficiently condemned his nephew Joe for making these comments. But, over time, they ended up working together for the people of Massachusetts and developing a warm relationship.
Yeah. Elizabeth from Monona, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm enjoying the conversation. I was on my way back from a doctor's appointment, It was very entertaining enough, so I'm going to go get the book because I want to read it.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
What I couldn't help but think, for a period, I was supported by the Kennedy Foundation in some research at UW. And so in the Department of Mental Retardation, without a doubt, they worked closely with Rick Heber, and I was familiar with the setting at St. Coletta.
Oh.
However, and that, of course, is on the plus side, but I noticed that you heavily delve into this situation with Kennedy's nephew. I really don't think that's probably as justified, because somebody's nephew is always gets in trouble. Really, I mean, he went out drinking. That drinking pattern was nothing new for him. I don't really think he can be blamed for the rape, but I do think that character is something that you inherit or you work hard to establish, and I have never felt comfortable with the Chappaquiddick situation.
Hmm.
And I don't think I ever will. I don't think anybody ever will. That is, I don't know how you can justify that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I strongly agree with you that the Palm Beach scandal was more a scandal of kind of political perception, that people were just kind of disappointed by Kennedy's, you know, heavy drinking lifestyle. But there was never any suggestion of immoral behavior on his part. I mean, I guess, you know, immoral behavior only if you believe that, you know, a single man dating a lot of women is, you know, problematic. But, it was of a whole different magnitude, a much lesser magnitude than the Chappaquiddick incident, where, you know, a woman died and where his own actions were implicated. And, I agree that it will be this sort of, part of his record forever, mm-hmm. and part of his legacy for history. I think that, as we said before, you know, he's worked very, very hard to kind of square the ledger and show his good intentions and show even his willingness to extend himself privately to people outside the political spotlight and work for the, you know, to use his what he's learned for the good of others. He's worked very, very hard to redeem himself in that regard, and a lot of people will give him credit for that.
Yeah. I know what she's saying, and I think that everybody would say there is an unsettling thing about Chappaquiddick that many people will always feel about him. He's had a complicated life. Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for the call. We need to talk about Vicky, and I can't remember who said this, but it might be a good way to talk about the marriage, that she was warned in a funny manner that the Senate came first in his life. Was it God who was second? The dogs were third and fourth, and she would be fifth?
Yeah, and she told her father laughingly, she understands that. She's up for it, which, Vicky, Reggie, one of the things that was sort of surprising to me is that Victoria Reggie, who became his second wife in 1991, she grew up in a family that was kind of like his, you know, a large Roman Catholic family. They happened to be in Louisiana, but the father, Edmund Reggie, who was actually a friend of Ted's and is just 6 years older than Ted, but Edmund Reggie had some of the same qualities of Joe Kennedy Sr. You know, he was kind of an American dreamer. He was politically ambitious, but he also kind of reveled in a large family and a large clan. And so Victoria Reggie was very familiar with the kind of life that Kennedy had been living, and from her own experiences, and was comfortable kind of navigating a, you know, large family and a complicated set of obligations. And so... So she turned into, a very comfortable match for him over time. There's about a 20-year age difference between the two of them, and she was a woman of a different generation than his first wife, and a career woman, a lawyer working in a law firm when he met her, and so it was a very, very different marriage than his first marriage to his wife Joan. But it turned out to be, something that
that brought a lot of joy and a lot of stability to what had been a troubled life.
Yeah. We do only have a few seconds left, Camille, so if you can make it brief. Hi, Camille.
Yes, hi. Well, you know, we always struggle with people who are in the limelight, who have personal lives that conflict with their profession, whether they're politicians or actors or whatever. But I do think that it's important to acknowledge that because he wasn't at the footlights, in a sense, you know, he wasn't in the forefront in the way that his brothers were. He was a little more behind the scenes, and ironically, that has allowed him to politically redeem or make up for the terrible Kennedy fate.
Yeah, he's been a powerful political force. There's no doubt about that. Peter, we're out of time. Thanks for the book. It's a great read, and thank you so much for your time. Like the discussion very much. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Peter Canellos, the book is Last Lion. I'm sorry, Camille, that's all the time we had, but it was a good way to end. The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy by the team at the Boston Globe. You can also go, if you want to, today to boston.com because they have video of a lot of what's discussed in this book, which is pretty neat. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.